You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of A Change of Heart by James Reginato. Most of the family wealth went into trust. From time to time, money would be dispersed to family members to meet their reasonable needs, as Susanna Andrews wrote in Shattered Dynasty, an account in the May 2003 issue of Vanity Fair of the epic family battle that erupted after Jay died in 1999, and some family members drafted a confidential plan to break up the fortune. According to that plan, 10 fourth-generation cousins would each receive $1.4 billion. Jay's 4 surviving children, Donald's 3 children, and Robert's eldest 3 children, Jennifer, Linda, and Karen, from his first marriage to Audrey, which ended in 1979. An 11th share would go to Nick, a third-generation nephew of A.N. An explosive challenge to this plan arose from Jennifer's younger half-siblings, Liesl, now 35, and Matthew, 37, the offspring of Robert's second marriage to Irene Dreiberg, which ended in a bitter divorce in 1991. Robert subsequently married Sal Myrie Sargent, with whom he had no children, before he died in 2011 at 85. Liesl and Matthew were shortchanged in this distribution plan, which resulted in a lawsuit that dragged on for years before a settlement was reached around 2005, by which they received about $500 million apiece. The others got their distributions as planned. Today, the cousins are all said to be back on amicable terms. Certainly, they are faring well financially. According to recent Forbes reports, Jennifer and Nick, for example, are each now worth around $2 billion, while JB's fortune is pegged at $3.2 billion. He was an early investor in Facebook. The richest Pritzker of all is Jennifer's Connecticut-based little sister, Karen, 61, with $5.1 billion. With her husband, Michael Vlock, she bought big into Apple, among other smart investments. Vlock, with whom Karen has 4 children, died in 2017. Outside of finance and politics, the Pritzkers have distinguished themselves in other fields. Jean, Gigi, 57, has produced films, including Drive and The Way, Way Back. Karen and Jennifer's sister, Linda, 66, is a Jungian psychotherapist and an ordained lama in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, who also goes by the name Lama Tsomo. A divorced mother of 3, she speaks fluent Tibetan and is an author, teacher, and co-founder of the Namchak Foundation, based on her ranch in Missoula, Montana. "There's one rule in the Pritzker family. Whatever you do, do it well," says Chicago socialite and novelist Sugar Rotbard, who has been a family friend for decades. "So it's a hard family to be happy in. The expectations are high, Olympian." At the same time, the Pritzkers have eschewed conspicuous consumption. Jay used to say, "We're rich socialists. They don't run around in jewels and sables," says Rotbard. "They hate being on the Forbes list." One aspect of being on that list rankles Jennifer particularly. "Forbes gave me a self-made rating of 1, she scoffs. "A 1 indicates the fortune was completely inherited. while a 10 is for a Horatio Alger-esque journey, says the magazine. I don't know anybody else listed in Forbes who went from private to lieutenant colonel. Army promotion boards could care less what your net worth is. You have to perform to certain standards to get in and to stay in. Clearly, military service helped Pritzker forge her sense of self-worth. In my youth, I had some trouble finding myself, she continues. It took me 5 years to get through high school with a 1.9 GPA. After attending Francis W. Parker, one of Chicago's elite private schools, class of 1968, Pritzker wandered around for 6 years, driving trucks in Arkansas for one of her father's companies, then riding the rails out west like a Dust Bowl hobo, before spending 9 months working on a kibbutz in two different locations in Israel. Being there during the outbreak of the 1973 Yom Kippur War was enlightening. Within 72 hours, 80% of the men of military age had gone into combat. I wanted to fight. Pritzker returned home and enlisted in the Army in February 1974, serving with the 82nd Airborne Division. Wanting to become an officer, Pritzker took a leave in 1978 to obtain the required bachelor's degree, enrolling at Loyola University in Chicago through the ROTC program, and sailed through in 2 years with a 3.6 GPA. Pritzker's mother, Audrey, was a fellow student. Finally getting her degree after being a busy mom, Jennifer explained last year when she announced a $10 million donation to Loyola in Audrey's honor. 2 years after her divorce from Robert, Audrey married Albert B. Ratner, a prominent real estate developer, and moved with him to Cleveland, where they still reside. She's still gorgeous, Rotbord says, of Audrey, 90. After receiving a degree in history, Pritzker returned to the Army, was commissioned as a captain, and served in the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and the VII Corps in Germany. While promotions came, my family life was suffering, she says. Daughter Tal was born at Fort Campbell in 1982, during Pritzker's first marriage to Israeli-born Eilat Ben Mordecai, which ended in divorce in 1987. She then married Lisa Gorin, an Illinois native, and they had Andrew and William before the marriage ended in 1997. After transferring to the U.S. Army Reserve and then the Illinois National Guard, Pritzker retired at the rank of lieutenant colonel and received an honorary promotion to full colonel, along with more than 20 military awards. I did not have a particularly heroic or distinguished career, but I did interesting things, she says. As her military career ended, Pritzker became increasingly active in Republican Party affairs. Cousin JB's recent gubernatorial run highlighted political divisions in the family. Shortly before he entered the race, JB tweeted, as a protest against Trump's rescinding protections for trans kids, everyone should use the other gender's bathroom today. Hashtag protect trans kids. It backfired, with all sides pouncing on him. One Democrat accused him of playing right into transphobic rhetoric. Not long after that, at a groundbreaking ceremony for one of her developments, a Tribune reporter managed to ask Jennifer if JB could expect her vote. If he wants to run, that's his privilege. I don't know where his current positions are, so I can't really answer that now. I think he was trying to be supportive, Jennifer told the same reporter about JB's tweet. I don't think he realized that informal comments on social media become world news quickly. JB issued a statement, "I have nothing but love and respect for my cousin Jennifer. While we belong to different political parties, we share a deep respect for individual civil rights. I have and always will support her." Did he get her vote in the end? "She'd like to pass on this question," says a communications aide, two of whom sat silently through our interview. Along with his wife, MK, and their foundation, JB was the third largest contributor to Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, with $12.6 million in donations. Jennifer, meanwhile, has ponied up in excess of seven figures over her lifetime, she says, to Republican candidates. "I think they've just accepted the fact that I vote for who I vote for, and write checks for who I do, and they vote and write checks for who they do," she comments. After a slight pause, Jennifer adds, "Riley, my mother voted for Eisenhower." "She does stand out in that way," cousin Nick told me by phone from his home in San Francisco, speaking of Jennifer's political leanings within the family. "She is a really admirable person. I have one point of view on a person and another of their political views. I don't conflate the two. I am not offended by Republicanism per se. I am offended by Republicanism as expressed by this administration." The greater Pritzker clan has long disliked Donald Trump for reasons non-political, too. In 1979, they became his partner in developing the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York, Trump's first major project. It was a rancorous and litigious relationship from which the Pritzkers extricated themselves in 1996 when they bought out Trump's half-interest. As Trump began his candidacy, Jennifer says she supported him for various reasons. "I did not want to see President Hillary Clinton. I had a lot of problems with her and her husband. I took a rather optimistic view of Trump. I thought that because he wasn't a politician, he would be willing to take some risk that professional politicians wouldn't. I thought he would take more favorable positions on taxes and gun control. And I thought he would be at least as LGBTQ-friendly as any Democratic candidate." She was disturbed when Trump referred to McCain as a loser, but still hung in. "I recognized he had a tendency to say impulsive things, but I felt a lot of his positions were ones I could agree with." Cut to July 2017. "Well, that tweet hit close to home," she says. "One aw shit wipes out 1,000 attaboys. It was his impulsiveness, his lack of thought, that I resent most," she continues. The military had done all kinds of surveys and studies evaluating whether the policy was feasible. Then he just arbitrarily said transgenders couldn't serve. "I don't know what he was really trying to accomplish. To placate the extreme end of his party, or create a bargaining chip for the wall? Well, I don't want to see my life and the life of people like me become a political poker chip. I felt he disrespected a whole category of people in a really thoughtless way. And if he disrespects one category, everybody is subject to that. Everybody has the right to be considered on their own merits." Though she still considers herself a Republican, she says the party will have to work for any future largesse from her. "If I do donate, it will be on a more selective basis," she says. "I'm going to want to see more of a solid track record." In recent years, Pritzker, who also serves on the board of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, has tapped into her vast coffers to support trans rights. Her gifts include $6.5 million to the Program of Human Sexuality at the University of Minnesota, $5.99 million to Palm Center, an LGBTQ think tank for a study on trans people in the military, $2 million for the world's first chair of trans studies at the University of Victoria, British Columbia, $1 million to Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago for a gender and sex development program, and $50,000 for the first trans study course at the University of Toronto. I don't know what the solutions are, but I think people with an MD, such as the physicians at Lurie Hospital, are more likely to find the answers than politicians in Washington, she says. Nobody is 100% male or female. It's difficult to make a precise science out of it, but the emotions are real. And is she being received with open arms by the LGBTQ establishment? That the military ban is the only thing about Trump that has upset her is horrendous, the director of one of the leading national advocacy groups tells me, fuming. The request for anonymity was out of deference to the family at large. But Sarah Kate Ellis, president and CEO of GLAAD, the world's largest LGBTQ media advocacy organization, offered a very positive assessment. Colonel Pritzker's voice has been very critical to the debate about transgender military service, not just because she is a veteran who understands what it means to prioritize military readiness, unit cohesion, recruitment, and retention, but also because she reminds us that this is not, and never should be, a partisan political issue. It's simply doing the right thing. On April 4th, a week before the military ban went into effect, the PMML and GLAAD co-sponsored a high-powered panel discussion on transgender military service on Capitol Hill. Speakers included Nancy Pelosi, Congressman Joe Kennedy, and via video message, Pritzker. It's critical that we stand together, in spite of party lines, to support our transgender service members as they have stood for us, she said. On a grassroots level, Pritzker's leadership is appreciated too. The number one thing she has done for the trans community is just being visible, says Miles Brady Davis, press secretary at Equality Illinois and a trans man. Visibility is a luxury a lot of trans people cannot afford. It can cost them friends, jobs, housing, even their lives. So her stepping up and saying, "This is who I am," that saves lives. Jennifer's greatest admirers have known her since she was a baby. "I always thought she was the bravest person in our family," says John Pritzker, 66, another first cousin. "She's always been very much her own person." My feeling about her transition was, thank God, because it gave her the freedom to be exactly who she is. It makes us a more interesting family, too. As a kid, she had all these toy soldiers, John adds. But she wasn't just playing around. She would recreate Napoleonic battle scenes. Intellectually, she is maybe the smartest person in our family. She is incredibly courageous, says Nick Pritzker, 73. I am very happy she is able to be who she is. I am confident that represents the view of all of my generation and below. I can't speak for the last generations, but I know my cousins well enough to know that they are all very supportive of her. Even for a billionaire with a loyal family, transitioning is arduous. I've had troubles and woes being transgender. Anyone who is, does, she says. Anyone who's transgender, I think, has, like, this inner compass. Whenever it is used, it will point to true north. Femininity is my true north. I think I had these feelings going all the way back to when I was a child. I had a dual current. I had a male body, but I would gravitate to feminine things, like wanting to dress. in my youth, in a lot of places, it was against the law. And forget about going in the army. For years, Pritzker cross-dressed in private. It was a vehicle, a tool, to take you to another state. I discovered that I really do think of myself inwardly as a female. I don't deny biological reality. I was born with a male body. But the whole point of being transgender is that human beings are complex and multidimensional. It is possible to have a person who has the physical characteristics of one sex, but the emotions and psychological makeup of the other. Now that she is out, she says dressing has become a little more complicated. I like to wear dresses or skirts, but I want stuff that's functional, that I can move in. I don't like pantyhose. I have found that a way to accomplish that mission is with bike shorts. I tend to gravitate to classical clothing. I wear a lot of things that could have been worn 50 years ago. I have impressions in my mind of things people wore when I was a child. The hardest thing for me is finding shoes. By women's standards, I've got gunboats, though by male standards, my feet are pretty average. At large in Chicago society, Jennifer is admired for her increasing activism and visibility. A man about town remarked of the frisson that fills a room when Jennifer walks in. It's like, forget Abra, Jennifer's here, he said, referring to Abra Rockefeller Prentice Wilkin, the longtime queen of Chicago society. I love Jennifer, says Rotbard. She's one of the best people on the planet. Such supportive community members eased Pritzker's transition, though it was not her choice to make it public so quickly. The media didn't really give me an opportunity to come out in a more orderly fashion, says Pritzker. I wanted to release it on terms that would be least stressful for my family and the people I work with. They had a right to know and needed to know. Unfortunately, the letter I wrote to the folks in my organization got leaked. Though Pritzker says there were some tough times with her sons, now 24 and 27, in her transition process, she now enjoys good relationships with them, as well as with her daughter, 38, a married mother of three. There's still a little bit of ambiguity. I'm still their grandfather, regardless of the exterior, Pritzker says. So they refer to me as Grandpa Jen, but they use the female pronoun. Some people in her life occasionally slip up and use the old name and pronoun, she says. I just sort of smile. If they are having a little trouble, I just say, pronouns. That's all. I know that when people do it, they are not intending to be demeaning or derogatory. Things just take a while to sink in. I mean, I still refer to where the White Sox play as Comiskey Park. When I ask Jennifer if she has a romantic partner, both press aides speak up. We're not commenting on that. I had reached the point where I was tired of fighting it out within myself. The world had become a more tolerant place. At least I wouldn't get arrested. And my children were grown, says Pritzker, of her decision to transition. Now I feel a lot calmer. I find I am able to think more clearly, because I don't have those inner conflicts anymore. I have come to accept who I am and try to make the best of it. Overall, I would say it's a net gain. Throughout the interview, I had been admiring the lovely gold medallion on her neck. As we wrap up, I ask about it. It's a golden dollar issued by the U.S. Mint, the head of Sacagawea, she says. I wore it today because I figured if she could get Lewis and Clark halfway across the continent from the Mississippi to the Pacific, well, maybe she'll get me through this interview. now a Vanity Fair spotlight by Nicole Sperling, out of office. With photographs by Jason Bell, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photo, what a ride. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, whose long-running series Veep ended in May. And she's shown emerging from the back seat of a black Mercedes, all dressed in white. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is nestled into a corner booth at the San Ysidro Ranch on a gloomy late spring day, a few weeks after Veep's seven-season flambeing of U.S. politics has come to its ash-black finale. AirPods in and curly brown hair pinned to the nape of her neck, she's 3,000 physical and psychological miles away from Selina Meyer, the soulless DC swamp creature she played on the HBO series. You might even mistake her as one of the rarefied women who can while away a Monday afternoon lunching at one of the finest establishments in all of California. I said to my husband, "I'm taking July and August off," and he kind of laughed. She says, "I'm going to try to stick to it," she continues, then pauses. "I'm looking for a new psychiatrist as we speak." Louis-Dreyfus has won the Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for each of the show's previous six seasons. Combined with another in the category for her work on The New Adventures of Old Christine in 2006, and one a decade earlier for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy for Seinfeld, Louis-Dreyfus is currently tied with Cloris Leachman for the most acting Emmys in history. It seems all but certain she will have the honor to herself as of awards night this year. She has had, in other words, one of American comedy's most fruitful runs, and a little break might seem to be in order. Yet, when we met, there was still much to do. One last Veep Emmy campaign, post-production on her upcoming film, her youngest son's college graduation. Next photo, making an entrance, Louis-Dreyfus photographed at the Montage Beverly Hills. Work, it turns out, and really only good work at that, is where Louis-Dreyfus seems to feel most complete. She loves grinding through a scene until the rhythm rings just right, when the jokes fly high and the insults land with finely calibrated precision. She seems to take breaks only when they are thrust upon her. So there's Louis-Dreyfus's undeniable work ethic to contend with, but there's also the fact that with rest comes thought, and the unenviable task of unpacking all that's happened to her in the last 3 years. Her beloved father died in September 2016. The following year, doctors diagnosed her with stage 2 breast cancer. She underwent 6 rounds of chemotherapy and a double mastectomy. Then, just as Veep was set to start filming, her 44-year-old half-sister died of an accidental drug overdose. "I hate to have to think about it," she says, "but I'm very happy to be alive." Lately, she's been trying mindfulness. "I realized I didn't meditate this morning, like an asshole, but I should have because it's useful. But stillness is just not her strong suit. And Hollywood does seem to be opening up to her in ways that are likely to accommodate her blooming ambitions, primarily delving into things that aren't necessarily comedic. I want to expand my creative universe here. I want to do stuff that maybe people wouldn't think I would do," she says. Her turn opposite James Gandolfini and Nicole Holofcener's 2013 drama-inflected romantic comedy, Enough Said, demonstrated that desire. Her dramatic vocabulary was also there at times in Veep, if you were paying attention, especially the moments when life wasn't going the way Meyer planned. That range will be front and center in Downhill, based on the 2014 Swedish film Force Majeure, a 5 years in the making passion project she produced and stars in opposite Will Ferrell. Louis Dreyfus plays a woman in crisis. Not the kind of manufactured ordeal Meyer trafficked in, but an actual human calamity wherein the life she thought she had turns out to be a total sham. "I just need time to think," she says, "on what will come after that. So I'm thinking, formulating my next move and shit like that, which is fun, but it also requires thought. And sometimes maybe no thought. Maybe I need time to just look at those flowers and think, wow, that's amazing. What a gorgeous arrangement." But soon, she is racing out of the restaurant as Veep showrunner David Mandel's number is ringing on her phone. "We've got to go write something," she says, as she heads for the door. From Julie Miller comes this Vanity Fair spotlight. Abbey Road, with photographs by Mark Neville. Opening photo, Grande Dame, Maggie Smith as Violet, the Dowager Countess of Grantham, photographed on the set of Downton Abbey at Shepperton Studios in Surrey. And Crown Jewels, Elizabeth McGovern as Cora, the Countess of Grantham. This September, royal mania hits Downton Abbey, and even the Lord and Lady succumb to palace obsession. When creator Lord Julian Fellowes sat down to spin his period drama series into a film, he knew he needed a premise sumptuous enough to satisfy the fans who will have spent nearly 4 years awaiting Lady Mary's return. You're looking for a central story that will bind everyone together, affect the characters upstairs, downstairs, and in the village, says Fellowes, who dreamed up a visit by the King and Queen of England to the Crawley estate in 1927. Picking up a year and a half after the series finale takes place, the film's storyline was inspired by an actual royal visit. That King George V and Queen Mary made to Wentworth Woodhouse, a country house in Yorkshire, in 1912, to restate the importance of monarchy, according to Fellowes. Like the real trip, Downton Abbey's royal extravaganza includes a spectacular parade created with hundreds of extras and period-precise costumes, cannons and horses, and white tie, wining and dining. The event is so large in scale that Carson, the family's beloved former butler played by Jim Carter, comes out of a palsy-induced retirement to return to Downton and ensure that nary a teaspoon is out of place. Mary reaches out for her hero Carson to save the day, explains Michelle Dockery of her character, who has taken over estate reins. I love that relationship between Mary and Carson. It's one of the lovely moments of the film. Next photo, Masterpiece Cinema, the Crawleys and the staff of Downton. Dame Maggie Smith, as the Dowager Countess and resident queen of Lethal Quip, gets a new sparring partner in Imelda Staunton, who plays the Dowager's distant cousin, Lady Bagshaw. A bit of Downton trivia. Staunton is married to Jim Carter in real life. Director Michael Engler expects that the cousin's locking haughty horns will especially delight Downton diehards. And fans need not worry for Lady Edith, Laura Carmichael, Lady Mary's long-suffering sister, who ended up marrying a Marquess. The delicious irony of where we left the TV series was that the most socially vibrant of the family ended up being the one who had the least success in love before, says Hugh Bonneville, who plays Crawley patriarch Lord Grantham, adding, little flashes of sibling rivalries still return when Edith visits. But on the whole, the family is pulling together in the right direction, and the forces of drama are actually external, which is quite fun. It's sort of Downton versus the world.
Thank you.
Here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Rick Owens, the visionary designer on the beauty of brevity and napping. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Gratitude. What is your greatest fear? Asphyxiation. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Robert de Montesquieu. Which living person do you most admire? I would never be able to choose. There are so many. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Impatience. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Hyperbole. What is your greatest extravagance? Naps. What is your favorite journey? To a nap. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Vivaciousness. On what occasion do you lie? I don't. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I don't worry about it. It could be worse. Which living person do you most despise? Despising isn't my thing. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I don't understand why, in a whiny tone. What is your greatest regret? Not allowing myself to be satisfied more often. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Hun. When and where were you happiest? Swimming in the sea. Which talent would you most like to have to do a perfect death drop? What is your current state of mind? Satiated. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I would judge less. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Absolutely nothing. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Longevity. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? A gray rock. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? An exotic, translucent marine organism writhing around orgiastically at the silent bottom of the sea. What is your most treasured possession? Health. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Addiction. Where would you like to live? Exactly where I do. What is your favorite occupation? Creation. What is your most marked characteristic? Maybe briefness. What is the quality you most like in a man? Humor. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Humor. What do you most value in your friends? Unblinking devotion. Who are your favorite writers? Colette, Beverly Nichols, John Richardson, Mallarmé, a long list. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Jean Dessent. Who are your heroes in real life? Artist. What are your favorite names? Hortense and Gaia. What is it that you most dislike? Spite. How would you like to die? Obliviously. What is your motto? Hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Rick Owens. In the next installment, we'll read the incredible article about the Harry Winston jewel heist in Paris. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle, well, we used to be called the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now, we're known as the North Carolina Reading Service, and we've been serving this area since 1983. Broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.